good. Probably. Anyway, I'm Rick Hansen. It's March 11th. Good. 2015. Yeah. And it's really not a pose. I mean, I'm just going in and out of like, where am I on time? But anyway. Anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about the topic I raised last week and then broaden it out and then see what you think. Okay? So very briefly, I talked about how very often we find ourselves in situations in which we're in networks of relatedness with other people, or more broadly, institutions, companies, banks, airlines, internet service providers, drivers, children, former lovers, current lovers, whatever, the elected representatives, senators who write letters to the government of Iran, the whole thing, right? And what do we do about the fact that very often we are drawn into relying upon that which is undependable? What do we do? And one of the things I talked about was, after we get through kind of the not so useful reactions to all that, you know, how do we practice with it? And I emphasized the idea for ourselves of disentangling, a theme the Buddha taught, spoke about a lot, as best we know, and pushing through our tendency, understandable and sweet, but a prescription for disaster, to overestimate the reliability of other people. And to have a longing in us for a secure attachment, or more exactly, a longing in us for other beings, caregivers, friends, allies, and all the rest, who are worthy of secure attachment, who are the basis for this profound need we have as social mammals and as scared little critters, you know, for others we can really depend upon. So there's kind of a collision between the fact that many people are not dependable in certain ways. They may be dependable in other ways, but we form relationships, we lean on them, we rely upon them, and then we just keep discovering, oh, wow, I can't count on you for that. You're not going to come through for me in that regard. You and I have a very different understanding of what an agreement is, right? You know, they're just, it's that way. So how do we disenchant ourselves? How do we wake up from the enchantment of an illusory, in some exaggerated sense, the word delusional view of other people? How do we actually do that? What drives all that? So that was kind of what I was getting into, right? And it's a very rich topic, including how do we disentangle from our own reactions around betrayal or hurt or resentment or vengeance, or, you know, I'll show you, I'm going to be the justice system of the universe, right? Get past that. But also, on the other hand, I'm going to use a really non-Buddhist word, don't be a chump anymore. In other words, wake up from the spell to see, okay, realistically, this is the way it really is. It might get better, I don't know, but this is what's the case, all right? And also, obviously, do our own practice. That's what we can depend upon for sure, our own practice. Just like you were saying in the back there, staying with it, extending practice periods, bringing a little more intensity to it, if that's appropriate, a little more quality being resolute. The Buddha talked about that. All right, we got to do our own practice. Okay. But having said all that, on that foundation, then I want to talk about two new things. Okay. The first is what drives us into trying to invest in networks, relationships, aspects of people that are going to disappoint us, right? How does that happen? And I think that happens in part because we don't feel secure in our own base here, in our body. And because we don't feel secure in the body, we look outside ourselves for sources of security. So I want to call out three points of practice where we can actually practice and develop more of a sense of being secure in the body here, so we can be more centered with and non-reactive and not angry and not defensive, and also not deluded about what's out there. And we can live with the ways in which, you know, things outside us aren't always so reliable. So one thing to do in the body is to really listen to the fact that almost all the time it's telling us that we're just fine. The body is basically okay, right? It's telling us that. Most of the inputs into the brain come from inside the body, and it's saying again and again, you're all right, it's enough air, you're getting older, your knee hurts when you cross your legs, you're okay, right? It's like listening to that and reminding yourself, you know, like, the body's okay, it's all right. I'm not threatened in this second. I'm not dying in this second, I'm not being eaten in this second, I'm not in excruciating pain in this second, it's really okay. A second thing to tune into is that the body is usually content. You know, it's got enough food. Most of us are fortunate. We don't live in a famine condition. We're not really dying of thirst. We're not, you know, just breaking down in this moment. There's enough. And most of us also have enough in our lives. You know, we have the conditions for amazing gratitude all day long. I was just thinking the other day about how much we take for granted the visual experience of being above, flying over. You know, we see pictures like that, we do that ourselves. Pretty much nobody had that opportunity, you know, until about a century ago. A very small handful of people went up in hot air balloons, many times dying in the process. But most of us today know what it's like to be above the ground, flying over it, looking down and seeing things from that perspective. Like, wow, everybody in this room, I believe, lives better than King Louis the 14th and the 16th and Marie Antoinette as well. You all live better than the kings of old. It's kind of in queens, kings and queens, emperors and empresses of old. Isn't that wild to appreciate? So anyway, so we have so many opportunities in the body to feel like there's plenty here. It's really okay. The body has enough in this moment. And then also to note, over here, you are loving. Isn't that wild? No matter what they do out there, you're still loving. Really. You can kind of feel it. Like, wow. I'm safe here, and I can feel peaceful. I don't need to be disturbed. There's no deficit of safety or disturbance of safety. Oh, this body is fed. It's full. How nice. It looks around, it sees beautiful things. Here's the sounds of good things, heating systems, lights. Amazing. Thank you, lights. You know? And then you look over here and like, what's up, really? Has my lovingness been destroyed? That would be a terrible loss, wouldn't it? Nope. It's intact. There's lovingness there. You know, and you can just tune right into it like, wow, I'm loving. You may be a schmuck, but I'm loving. You know, not like, look at me, I'm so loving, but just, wow. No one took that from you. No one took that from you. It's beautiful. It's like, it's okay. It's there already. You know what I mean? We don't need to go chasing out there. There's an enoughness here. All that chasing comes from a sense of deficit or disturbance, which is usually unfounded. Okay, so think about that in your own practice. You know, certainly the Buddha's path is really about this point, this transition from craving to not craving, deficit to fullness, disturbance to balance. Right? And a profound practice and a very simple and immediately available practice is to be mindful of more or less craving and increasingly let go of unnecessary, you know, fighting, fleeing, freezing, appeasing, and all the rest of that, right? And take our seat increasingly in the green zone, a mind relatively free of craving. Right? So I suggest you look to yourself and you just join me in doing a practice many times a day. Like, oh, is there the basis for peace over here? And then open into that. Oh, is there the basis for contentment, fullness, enoughness, gratitude over here? Oh, and open into that. And is there the basis for love over here? my own lovingness is the sufficient basis. Anyone's lovingness is the sufficient basis for love. It's not about what's happening outside. That's not a necessary basis for lovingness, for love. It's, are you a loving person? Is there love in your heart? Can you be loving? That's all it takes, and that's the case. Okay? So those are three really powerful practices. And as we do that, you can just find your mind kind of disentangling from craving, stepping out of craving. There's no disturbance. Then here's the second thing. What I'm talking about runs smack dab up against a kind of inherent aspect of existence and experience, which is that in our experience, all the time, built in by the nature of time itself, is the sense of things ending, crumbling, vanishing, right? So here we are. We have this visceral animal need to be safe and satisfied and connected, three primal needs, any animal, including us, right? And yet, the nature of phenomenology, the nature of our direct experience, just how it is that every instant ends, right? Impermanence, transience, everything changes. And so here we are with this deep need to be safe. And how do you be safe when it's all crumbling all the time, right? And on the other side of the, and in the next moment, right, out there, something might come and get us, right? How do we deal with that? Also, how do you maintain satisfaction when everything goes away? All the reward experiences end, you know? And then also, how do we stay connected to other people when we might disappear, they might disappear, right? So there's this funny, bone-deep tension in us between these three major drives, you know, safety, satisfaction, and connection, and the realities of the impermanence of experience and the temporal narrowness of this instant of now. Now is always vanishingly thin, right? It's easy to relate to this kind of headily or abstractly. It's really good to just bring it down, to just kind of observe, holy moly, experience is continually ending. And I think that freaks us out deep down. And many people have written about, philosophers have, you know, gone a great length about existential fear, because that's what I'm kind of talking about, the fear of ending, the fear of vanishing. You know, the fear of dying. And so out of that fear, I think a lot, we drive into these entangled networks of kind of sort of reliability with other people that then create lots of tension and trouble and suffering for us and for other people. So how do we practice with this process of the endingness, endlessly, the endless endingness of experience? How do we practice with that rather than get all crazy about it, which is the normal state? And that's where I think two things. The first is that really exploring what it's like to be at the edge of now as it vanishes, really in the now, is a strong practice in part because if you think about consciousness is like the windshield of a car, okay? Infinitely thin. That's now. And you can imagine time streaming this way with its bugs and flowers and lollipops coming toward us. And in terms of the brain, within about a tenth of a second or so of a stimulus occurring inside the body or outside, or just inside the nervous system, you know, within about a tenth of a second, it's hit the windshield of conscious experience, right? And there's attention. The neural networks of attending have three aspects to them. The first is called alerting. Something has happened. That's the first half second or so of processing, right? But remember, it's the first half second that's always the case. because time is streaming through us, right? Or if you like, we're moving forward into reality. But either way, it's time, okay? Oh, real soon. So what I'm trying to say about this is that if we practice resting in just being attentive right now, that alerting function, it really helps us feel connected to everything.
Right. Can you say that one more time?
Yeah, I will. I'll let you guys go, and I know you got to go. No worries. Oh, yeah. Hope you feel better.
Please excuse me.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No worries.
No.
Hope you feel better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. It sounds complicated. It's really simple. It's that if you just watch your own attention, like something happens, the first thing you know is that something has happened. You don't know what it is. You don't know where it is. But you know that something has happened, right? And then other networks in the brain orient to that thing. It's over there, friend or foe. And then third, start mounting a response. The point is, in particularly Zen practice around just sitting, if we are continually really present at the leading edge of the windshield of consciousness and just kind of hanging there and really, really letting go continually, we train in and we strengthen the neural substrates of this network of alerting. We increasingly, we're just hanging there in the leading edge of the windshield of now, right? Letting go very rapidly. And what that does is it strengthens related networks that help us feel one with everything. Right? That's one reason why I think great teachers again and again talk about being in the present moment. Because one of the benefits is it strengthens those networks that help us feel connected to everything, which goes to the second point I had about this, and then I'll see what you think. It's that how do we be with the endingness of everything? One way to be with it, and I think is a deep training for people in traditional practices, is to feel a part of everything. So we can include, for example, the sounds out there and our wondering, the emotions, the reactions, whatever they are. It's like, oh. And you start to realize that what you are experiencing right here is just a local ripple through the whole ocean of reality, right? Just here, that's all that's here. So here we are, we're like this little kelp, or you know, kelp floating on the surface of the sea. And then all these little ripples go through us that began, you know, 10,000 miles away because somebody on a cruise ship threw a Coke bottle overboard. And it rippled all the way across the sea, right? Here we are today with all the ripples through us of other people, events around us, the natural world, the long causes of evolution, biological evolution, just rippling through us. And after, so then what starts to happen is you become increasingly okay with it all ending because it all keeps going. It all keeps going. And you feel part of this whole allness that's ongoing more and more. And there's no problem. So I'll close with these kind of three things that have been in my mind lately about this. No problem. No pressure. No self. That's my talk tonight. For the body to feel more secure?
Yeah.
Yeah. The first is to let fear go. You know, to really let go the sense of being threatened. And you could do it here. And, you know, this I'm linking this to the meditation instructions I was giving. Just really, what is it like to just not have any trouble here? You know, to be untroubled, to not be afraid. And in it's really interesting because there could still be anxiety, because maybe we're anxious as a person, or our mind is just still kind of caught worrying about our child or a friend or something, right? But it could be in a context of, it's not a problem that I'm worried. That was my first one, because and the rest, the other two were just to feel open to feeling contentment here and letting go of grasping. No need to chase. It's okay. It's full already. And then on relationship, I just find again and again the most reliable thing, for me at least, that grounds out my neurosis, in my relational neuroses, the fastest way, boom, is to return to my lovingness here, which is really kind of counterintuitive. But for me, it just... And then from that base of my own lovingness here, I feel much more equipped to deal with whatever. Okay. Yeah?
I'm wondering if what she was asking was the instinctual three things, the safety...
Satisfaction
and connection.
Well, I was asking what he said, but that's interesting.
Well, that was what you were talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's... So those three things are instinctual in life on Earth?
Yeah, all animals try to be safe, you know. Plants, too, in a sense. And to get food and shelter and water, and then, we got a new refrigerator today because we need one. On sale from Sears, but anyway, there it is in our garage now. So, it's more than just, humans have more elaborated needs, obviously, But it's really interesting in the moment to just, you can do it right now. Are you on edge at all right now? And can you let that go, Is there any sense of wanting more of anything? Can you let that go? And is there any sense of interpersonal disturbance? Can you let that go? And find what helps you let that go. And when you let it go, you don't rest in a big blank. And we're not numbing out. We actually have this luscious fullness of peace, contentment, and love, one aspect or another.
Rick?
Sure.
It all sounds wonderful in this room, but in the real world, seriously.
Yeah. I am serious. I am serious.
Yeah, I'm really not trying to be funny. I'm just saying in the real world, but you can be in situations where people are wanting too much of you, and they are making you anxious, and they're not loving, and they're criticizing you, and so it's hard to stay in that. What do you do when?
Yeah.
I don't want to say under attack, but
Yeah, I think you practice off the field, like we're doing in here, and we try to practice. It's like, learning to ski, whatever. They don't start you out on a black diamond slope. It's kind of very gentle. They get you organized. You start in a more contained environment, right? And then you spread out from there. So, and then on the field, we try to draw on what we've acquired off the field and do the best we can. That said, for me, I have several little things that come through my mind. First, I try to notice if I'm getting plugged in, finger in the wall socket, like we've had two events in here. If you're really tracking the subtlety in your body, I'm a pretty mellow guy and I've practiced a long time, both events. I could feel myself starting to get a little tense. It's okay. That's what animals do. It's a normal signal. Okay. But then we can look more closely and explore, maybe with a little bit of verbal thought in the mind, but also with kind of like more emotional and not verbal, is there actually a problem here? Is this a big problem or a little problem? Is it my problem? Often it's not my problem, I mean this with a lot of respect and kindness and inclusion of a really long-standing people in our Sangha. If someone needs to leave, it's not my problem. And I don't mean that in any kind of a snippy way. I just mean it very objectively. It's simply, it's my problem to not be a jerk about it or to be supportive, or, you know what I mean, or manage the group as a whole. Those are my problems, as it were. But many things that we get entangled, remember entanglement? We tangle up in, it's actually not our problem. So that's one thing I do. And I also, I have a very strong sense of my own, how can I put it? Independence from what's happening around oneself. Again, you know, am I bound to this or controlled by it necessarily? Or do I have an internal freedom? You know, like Viktor Frankl kept talking about, to choose my response. As he says, between stimulus and response is a space. In that space is our freedom. You know, and then with practice, we just get better and better at it. It also helps to have a certain cheerfulness. And
projecting, right? It's another form of it, just not projecting.
Yeah,
not
and a,
projecting.
That's right. A cheerfulness and I think also a kind of compassion. And I find often when other people, if we radiate, I've been doing this more and more with people on the street. If we kind of radiate, you know, as appropriate, not being socially inappropriate and not being invasive if people don't want the eye contact, to make a little bit of eye contact with someone passing by you at an airport or in a delicatessen or at a restaurant, or the server comes to take your order, whatever, at lunch, and to just radiate that little pulse of, I'm not a threat. You know, I see you. You know, I'm for you. I wish you well. I had a guru for a while. He talked about it as the blessing disposition. It's kind of a little pulse. And I just started to think about the power in this whole wide world if more people would do that. Just take the extra 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds, just kind of pulse it, and then see what to do from there. And I find that when we do that a lot with other people, they kind of settle down, usually, not always. Great, Tom, a couple more, and then we'll finish on time.
Relating to the awareness of now, I remember when I first heard Eckhart Tolle describe his pad on his CD, Power of Now, and the feeling I remember is his excitement, his euphoric feeling and response when he discovered the now.
Yeah.
And it really struck me.
Yeah.
That this excitement about it, not, you know, we talk a lot about the remorse of every moment ending, but that's what I remember, and that's what I try to bring into my now practice.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And again, to bring it, you know, there's a place for pointing out instructions and so forth, but I think where it really is important is just keep bringing it back. You know, like, what's it like, and can you start extending moments that are like this for yourself, as Tom said, where you just kind of now and fine, right? Good enough. Maybe your leg hurts a little and there's some background worry, but basically now fine, love you, right? And then just kind of hang there. And as a final thought about that, you may know the idea from baseball. It's the idea that you bring up a rookie, you know, and they're in the major leagues and maybe even the World Series. They call it the big house, like a temple, the green grass, and it's all beautifully manicured. And there's this kind of cultural thing for rookies coming up to the majors who say, I'm just glad to be here, right? And I thought about how for us, every moment, I mean, we are transient patternings of stillness that will end inevitably. Allness will keep on going, resting in stillness. But our local patterning, all bleeding stops eventually, one way or another, right? All eddies disperse eventually, right? So, and yet meanwhile, holy moly, 13.7 or so billion years after the universe began, you know, the only intelligent life as we know it, I just feel like every day, Every second, every breath, every instant of now is like being a rookie in the big house. Oh my God, I'm just glad to be here. Blink. Wow, rookie in the big house. Glad to be here. Heartbeat. Wow, rookie in the big house. So glad to be here. You know, it could be like raining. You know, my shoe could be too small. Wow, I don't care. Thank you. I was playing double-A baseball in Fresno last week. Now, and right, rookie in the big house. Every second, every instant, it's like we're just rookies in the big house going, thank you. Let's sit for a minute. Be well. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.